This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. Good morning, Ines.
Good morning, Priya. How are you?
I'm okay. It is Thursday, the 12th of March. How are you doing now that we are into the third month of the year?
I was just telling Priya before we started that I pulled out the trench coat today, which is nice. I love the nice cold weather. And yeah, I guess the one of the things that's been keeping me going is watching the Asian Women's AFC Cup. And there's some, like, we're getting through the fixtures. And the next fixture on Saturday is China versus Taipei. So geopolitically, that will be a very interesting match. But I'm really looking forward to it. And yeah, there's been a lot of important topics that have come out from that. But what's been keeping you going this week?
Well, keeping me going, my gripes, as usual. Nobody in Melbourne, if you live in Melbourne, you can't drive and you cannot change my mind. And if you live in Melbourne and you think you can drive, text us on 0488 809 855. That is 0488 809 855, and I will read your message to myself, but not on air. Fascinating. Just like I nearly, the number of accidents that I nearly witnessed that even have nothing to do with me as a cyclist. I'm like, what's going on, guys?
What's happening?
What's going on? I know I can't drive. That's why I don't.
Me too.
Yeah. But, you know, some people need to stay in their lane, both literally in the car and also figuratively in terms of, you know, play to your strengths. If you're good at walking, just do that.
Yeah.
It's chill. Just do that. And there's also plenty of excellent public transit around Melbourne. But we've got a stacked lineup for you today on Thursday Breakfast. And to start off with, we're going to be joined by Tilman Ruff, who's the co-founder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. And we'll be talking about Australia's entanglements with nuclear-armed states in light of the ongoing US-Israeli war on Iran. And Australia's military and intelligence relationships with the United States are particular cause for alarm, especially under the AUKUS agreement and Five Eyes alliance. So we'll also be talking about broader international developments in nuclear agreements and the urgent need for Australia to ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
And then we play an excerpt of Agapi Pashos of the Greek Demokritis Workers League speech from the 28th of February this year, commemorating the third anniversary of the Tempe tragedy. And the segment discusses decades of austerity and endemic corruption that led to the death of 57 people and the diaspora's role in fighting for justice and systemic change in Greece. And then we play an excerpt of beloved 3CR host, former Tuesday Breakfaster, and Kalagi Women on the Line interview with Avika about combating the climate crisis through regenerative farming, the role of women in sustainable farming, and really interestingly, the links between corporate farming and patriarchal culture and the benefits of growing your own food. Avika is a regenerative farmer in Chiang Mai in Thailand and really passionate about making these tools and techniques accessible. And you can listen to Women on the Line on Mondays from 8:30 a.m.
Amazing. And then finally, we'll be joined by Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch to continue the conversation about the Australian government's relationships with US-based data analytics software company Palantir in light of exclusive reporting this week by Crikey on the contents of a contract that embeds Palantir staff within the Department of Defense. And we'll include a link to that article, which is by Cam Wilson and titled Palantir Embedding Staff in Defence and Mining Australian Data Under Contract with Trump-Aligned Company in our show notes. So stay tuned. We will be with you all the way until 8:30 in the morning, and we will come back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Melbourne Food and Wine Festival hosts Feast for Freedom with the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre for one night only. Join us for an exclusive communal dining experience at the ASRC's Home of Hope in Footscray on Wednesday, the 25th of March. Share a long table feast created by refugee chefs from Palestine and Sri Lanka. Celebrate incredible food and help raise vital funds for people seeking asylum. Tickets are limited. Book now at feastforfreedom.org.au/MFWF. Feast for Freedom is an initiative of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 12th of March. Reporting by Declassified Australia this week shows the Albanese Labor government is playing a significant role in the United States-Israeli assault on Iran and other areas in the region. Facilities such as Pine Gap and the Harold E. Holt Naval Communications Station are providing intelligence and communications for United States forces, and Australian military personnel are embedded at bases in the UAE, Bahrain and Qatar. Declassified Australia's Peter Cronell said this support means the Australian government is failing to be transparent about how deeply involved with Israel and the United States it is. United States and Israeli strikers across Iran and the wider Middle East this week, including attacks on oil facilities and other infrastructure, having killed more than 1,300 people in Iran and hundreds more in Lebanon, injuring thousands of people and displacing hundreds of thousands. Also in news, Federal Labor proposed amendments to the Migration Act have this week received widespread condemnation from migrants, advocates and rights organisations. The amendment will mean the Home Affairs Minister can block groups of temporary visa holders from travelling to so-called Australia through a, quote, arrival control determination, end quote, raising concerns that ministerial bans would not be transparent and not be able to be disallowed or reversed by Parliament. Senator Lydia Thorpe labelled the proposed amendments as racist dog whistle, and the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, or ASRC, said the legislation could prevent people fleeing countries such as Iran and Lebanon and entering, even if they hold valid temporary visas.
In other news, the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, known as VALS, says the Federal Parliamentary Inquiry into Racism, Hate and Violence against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is a step in the right direction, but argues the ongoing and systemic racial violence faced by First Nations people warrants nothing less than a national royal commission. Advocates note that the inquiry will have significantly less resourcing and influence than the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, and that the experiences of Aboriginal people are considered less significant, with political motivations seeking to limit First Nations voices. VAL CEO Narita Waite said the lack of condemnation and action in response to a terrorist threat at an Invasion Day rally in January in Borloo, Perth, is a clear example of this. And finally, in headlines this week, people in Victorian prisons spent more than $12 million on phone calls between 2021 and 2024, with calls costing 57 cents per minute or $6.84 on the maximum 12-minute call. Victorian prison calls were among the most expensive in the country. Prisoners earned between around $7 and $10 per day for work, meaning a single call could cost most or all of a day's wages, causing significant barriers to maintaining contact with family and community. Advocates say that the figures highlight deep inequities in the prison system and have renewed calls to make prison phone calls free or priced the same as in the community, arguing stronger family connections, support, well-being, and reduced reoffending. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 12th of March, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Music. In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 03 9419 8377.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:10 in the morning, and we might do a quick weather check for today. As Inez mentioned at the top of the show, it is pretty cold today. We are looking at a maximum of 19 degrees in Narm, a shower or two, and at the moment it is sitting at around 14.4 degrees Celsius. So it should be clearing up later in the day, but it will be cloudy. It looks like temperatures are starting to steadily decrease. Now, I wanted to mention that Peter Cronow article and the conversation that we had with Peter last week about Australia's relationships with the United States, with Israel, and through these signals intelligence, but also strategic military partnerships. It has been incredibly helpful to be able to read declassified Australia's reporting on this, and there's just been some really excellent and rigorous reporting by declassified Australia. So I just wanted to shout them out and their incredible work. And I've also found it really, really helpful to access independent reporting via Dropsite News on the situation in Iran, but also looking at what's happening in Lebanon, in Palestine, and just in the broader Gulf region as well, as U.S.-Israeli aggression continues. And I think this is a really important thing for us to keep an eye on because of the escalating Australian complicity, especially via now the Albanese government's decision to send a wedge-tail aircraft and to put more military personnel in the Gulf to basically support the UAE, which is, yeah, extremely concerning. But as we spoke about with Peter Cronow last week, it's not just a question of boots on the ground. These relationships and the sharing, especially of signals intelligence, means that Australia has been complicit whether or not there are Australian military personnel on things like, for example, a nuclear-powered submarine where three Australian personnel were on the vessel that torpedoed the Iranian ship that was off the coast of Sri Lanka. We're seeing reports that those personnel were told to go to their bunker at the time of the torpedoing. I think it is really important to remember, though, the fact that they were there really means something about this partnership. And this is what the AUKUS deal has locked us into. So we're hoping to bring you much more coverage of these issues over the coming weeks. But I just wanted to jump in with that quick update. You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
trans liberation, poo-poo on the turfs,
abolition,
anti-racism,
sex worker rights,
staff liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonisation,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio File.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio File, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English. So
practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio File, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR, 855 AM, or you can listen online, 3cr.org.au.
Radio File.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your app.
You are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is coming up on 7:17 in the morning. And we are now joined by Tilman Ruff, who is the co-founder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. And Tilman is joining us to discuss Australia's entanglements with nuclear-armed states in light of the ongoing US-Israeli war on Iran. Now, Australia's military and intelligence relationships with the United States are a particular cause for alarm, especially under the AUKUS agreement and the Five Eyes alliance. And we're also going to be discussing some international developments in nuclear agreements and the urgent need for Australia to ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Tilman Ruff is a public health and infectious diseases physician, honorary principal fellow at the University of Melbourne School of Population and Global Health, board member and past co-president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, a co-founder and founding international chair, Australian chair of ICAN, and a member of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons Scientific Network. Good morning, Tilman.
Good morning, Priya. Thanks for that very generous introduction and for having me.
No, of course. I mean, I really appreciate you making the time to come on. And I think it is really important to turn to folks who have been involved in this struggle against nuclear weapons for, you know, a long time to contextualize the present moment. I did want to ask you a couple of quite broad-ranging questions because I think a lot of things have come up in light of, you know, the war on Iran and especially around the AUKUS deal and relationships between Australia and the United States. And this is a question, maybe this is mainly for me, but I wanted to clarify the difference between nuclear-capable and nuclear-powered submarines and how these compare in terms of nuclear non-proliferation concerns.
Sure. Well, nuclear power is widely used for naval propulsion, particularly for submarines, because they can stay underwater for a longer time and travel longer distances reasonably quickly. So that's mainly the reason why naval propulsion is used. It's also used for icebreakers. Russia has a number of those, and for some surface ships. So it does provide a possible means of propelling ships, and some countries like particularly the United States and the United Kingdom, actually use highly enriched weapons-grade uranium to run those reactors in their submarines. So that's a particular safety issue, but it's also a proliferation issue because that material is directly weapons usable. And one of the issues for Australia is that the submarines that will come here, if they do, will be powered by that bomb fuel. So it requires extreme security and is a proliferation danger that's very difficult to safeguard effectively on a mobile stealthy platform that nobody's supposed to know where it is most of the time. And the waste that comes out of those submarines will still be weapons grade for many thousands of years. So that's a proliferation problem. But of course, many of these nuclear powered vessels also carry nuclear weapons. The United States, for many decades now, since 1991, in fact, President Bush the Elder decreed that nuclear weapons should come off U.S. naval ships and attack submarines, so just the ballistic missile-carrying submarines. So the submarines that plan to visit Australia in increasing numbers and essentially be permanently based off Fremantle increasingly over the next year or two, they currently don't carry nuclear weapons, although they are nuclear powered. But there is a plan that the Trump administration is progressing quite actively to develop a new nuclear armed cruise missile that is likely to go back on those submarines. So probably within a couple of years, it's quite likely that those submarines that will be visiting Australia will again be possibly carrying nuclear weapons, be capable of doing so. And I think extremely regrettably, in Senate estimates late last year, senior officials of both the Foreign Affairs and Defence Department, including Greg Moriarty, who will be the next Australian ambassador to the United States, said, "We accept that the United States doesn't say whether its vessels are carrying nuclear weapons or not, and we're okay if nuclear weapons are brought into Australia." So while for many decades Australia has provided eyes and ears through Pine Gap and Northwest Cape and other facilities that provide important information for nuclear targeting and command and control, increasingly we're actually moving towards operational basing of nuclear-capable forces in Australia, both through the submarines and through the B-52s that are planned to be placed in the Northern Territory. But ships can be nuclear-powered without carrying nuclear weapons or being nuclear-capable, but many of them also have the capability of carrying nuclear weapons.
Thank you so much for clarifying that, because I think it is really important to understand the risks that come with even just nuclear-powered submarines using the kind of technology that you have described, and the push towards, having them carry nuclear payloads is incredibly concerning. You did mention the B-52, so I did want to ask about, the arrangement between Australia and the United States allowing for the deployment of nuclear-capable U.S. B-52H Stratofortress aircraft at the RAAF base in Tyndall. So what do we know about this, and how does that sit in relation to Australia's international obligations?
Well, I think the answer is not very well, and this is a really concerning development. The B-52s are planned to be, like the troops in Darwin, on permanent rotation. So it's not technically called basing by the government, but effectively it is. It's a permanent presence. It's like fly-in, fly-out workers, where the facilities and infrastructure and the work they do is continuous. It's just the people that are doing it varies. It's effectively the same thing. So they've already got that kind of system for the troops that are in Darwin. And the euphemism that's used is that these will be on permanent rotation in Tyndall. So this is a permanent presence. And over the last couple of years, there have been about $1.5 billion Australian dollars worth of construction that's specifically dedicated to host these B-52s. So dedicated, these are massive aircraft. So special hangars, special aprons, because they're so heavy, the concrete that they sit on has to be especially thick. Fuel storage, ammunition storage, and the permanent presence of between 100 and 150 US personnel specifically to service and maintain those aircraft. That's not just, you know, a brief transit visit. That has to be considered by any practical interpretation that's facing. So until now, half of the American B-52 bomber fleet has not been capable of carrying nuclear weapons because of the New START treaty, so which put limits on both the number of warheads and the number of launchers, so submarines, planes that could carry nuclear weapons. Now that, as of last month, the New START treaty has gone, there are no longer any limits. And the legislation is already in place, was put in place actually under the Biden administration, for the administration, if it wants, so President Trump essentially, and his staff, to instruct the Secretary of the United States Air Force to make those B-52s nuclear capable again. It's relatively quick and inexpensive to do. So Australia, one of the options that we've been arguing is that Australia should say, we only want the non-nuclear capable ones in Australia, thanks very much. But that option is likely to disappear. So that it will probably be the case that all of the B-52s will soon be nuclear capable, the ones that will be based here. So this means that potentially nuclear weapons could be brought into Australia and launched from Australia, even without our knowledge or consent. This is a really significant step up in Australia's nuclear entanglement and our role in assistance for any war that turns nuclear that the United States might prosecute.
Yeah, that is extremely, extremely worrying to hear that, you know, Australia could potentially become a base for launching nuclear attacks.
And I should have said that, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. And there are, in the 1980s, Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, Conservative, because he was extremely concerned about the accident risk of B-52s on a series of exercises in northern Australia across both Western Australia and Queensland, where the planes were going to fly very low, so 100, 150 metres above the ground, he was really concerned about an accident, a crash. And that was one of the reasons why he insisted, and he's in fact the first leader and still the only leader to have done so, but it worked effectively. He said to the United States, you will not bring armed B-52s to Australia, and you will publicly declare that you will comply with our requirement that they not be armed when they're in Australia. And the US did so for basically most of the decade of the 80s. Regrettably, the current government hasn't been willing to put any conditions on the B-52 visits. So that really makes us complicit increasingly and even more deeply enmeshed, not just in providing eyes and ears that help nuclear forces, but the actual basing and operations of potential delivery of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, that is an important historical anchor for us to be able to turn to, especially when people are thinking about precedent for rolling these measures back. Now, I wanted to return to the New START Treaty. So that's a treaty between the United States and Russia, and it placed a limitation on the strategic nuclear arsenals of both nations. And as you mentioned, it expired on the 5th of February this year. So what is the status of this agreement or agreements of this nature between the United States and Russia, and what are the implications?
Well, that was the last, that New START Treaty, which capped the numbers of long-range weapons. So strategic weapons just means the big long-range ones that are designed to, you know, travel around essentially anywhere around the world within about half an hour. It capped the numbers of those and the number of launches for those. So that treaty only had the provision to be extended once. It was initially for 10 years. It was signed by Presidents Obama and Medvedev in 2010. And it lasted for 10 years. And then when the Biden administration came in, the Russians said, we're willing to extend it for another 5 years, which was provided for in the treaty. The first Trump administration refused to do that. But Biden came to office just before the treaty expired, couple of days before and also agreed to extend it. So that's why it lasted another 5 years. But there wasn't the capacity to extend it again. Russia did offer, in September last year, President Putin offered that even when the treaty expired, that Russia would be willing to respect the limits that the treaty provided for another year, hopefully while they might negotiate something to replace it. But President Trump didn't respond positively to that either. And so that last remaining treaty constraint on the two nations that have between them 87% of the world's nuclear weapons has now gone. And that's a real problem because that's not just the cap on the numbers of long-range weapons, but there were also a whole bunch of provisions that went with that treaty for regular notifications of Russia and the United States of what they were doing with their nuclear forces, what they were developing, what they had where. So provided a lot of transparency and helped to minimize worst-case planning on either side. There were also mechanisms to resolve disputes. There was capacity for short-notice inspections of the sites where those nuclear missiles and launch and bombers and submarines were based. So each side could actually physically go and see, verify what was there. So there was a lot of almost daily communication between the military forces managing nuclear weapons on both sides that really assists in terms of understanding and risk reduction and reducing potential for miscommunications and misinterpretation that a nuclear exercise somewhere might be, in fact, the plans the beginning of a nuclear strike, or that an exercise that moving missiles to one place, you know, could signify plans for an attack. It really helped to create communication and understanding at a military-to-military level, and that's now gone as well. And because both sides have so many weapons in reserve that have been retired and not yet dismantled, that are not deployed currently but that are available, they could essentially within a matter of months effectively double the number of strategic warheads that they have deployed and available for launch. So we're really, it does really unfortunately, but I think it has to be said that it basically cements a pretty dangerous trend of essentially we're back in an unrestrained arms race. You know, this is the first time in half a century that there have been no constraints of any kind on the two largest nuclear arsenals.
I think, reflecting on the current conflict between Russia and Ukraine and the United States, relationship to that, it is vital to keep an eye on whether anything will ultimately replace the New START treaty and whether, the fact that it has expired without new negotiations in place signals, a trend towards even further escalation in the United States' development of nuclear capabilities and its willingness to use this as a threat. I don't want to use the language of deterrence here because I think it's a bit, it almost seems a bit limited.
Yes, I think it's a scam, to put it simply. But yes, there's nothing being negotiated to replace New START or any of the other treaties that have progressively been abandoned. The Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that eliminated all short and medium range nuclear armed missiles between Russia and the United States, effectively implemented on time. The Open Skies Treaty that provided, again, a high level of transparency, allowing overflights and surveillance of military activities in both countries. All of the treaties that have gone by the wayside have really put the world in a more dangerous place. President Trump has insisted that China be involved in any new negotiations on nuclear arms control. That really is essentially saying, putting an obstacle that doesn't need to be there. It may well be a pretext for not wanting to negotiate with the Russians and essentially having free rein to do as he wishes, as he seems to be flexing military muscle completely in contradiction to international law and obligations of the United States.
Mm.
So the Chinese arsenal, even though it's growing rapidly, is still about 10% of the size of either the American or the Russian arsenal. The Chinese haven't previously been involved in any arms control negotiations, and their very consistent, flatly put position is until the Russian and American arsenals are much closer in size to theirs, they're not talking. So that seems to be setting it up for failure, really, and there's no reason to put that condition on any further discussions between Russia and the United States. But in this sort of toxic environment of lack of respect for international law, international cooperation diminishing on multiple fronts, there's no talks about talks even at mm-hmm. present between Russia and the United States.
Yeah, and in the midst of all of this, I want to return to Australia, which has this week deployed an E-7A Wedgetail aircraft to the Gulf and is committed to supplying advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles to the United Arab Emirates. Now, for this and other reasons, including its AUKUS involvement in signals intelligence partnerships with the United States, it seems Australia is increasingly at risk of becoming a nuclear target itself. Could you comment on this?
Well, Australia, since it has been a close US ally, providing, claiming protection from, supporting United States nuclear weapons and providing assistance for their possible use through facilities, particularly at Pine Gap and at Northwest Cape. So Pine Gap, part of it, a big vacuum cleaner for all sorts of electronic communications and phone and internet transmission. Part of it also infrared satellite downlinks, so the satellites that pick up the heat plume from explosions or missile launches that can tell you which silos are empty or not and can help cue missile defence. So that crucial communication, since we started cooperating with the United States and Pine Gap was established back in the 1960s, Australia has been a high priority target for any adversary of the United States. So it's been widely acknowledged, including through multiple parliamentary processes, that Australia is a high-priority nuclear target for Russia and now for China, and the Chinese have said so, because of those facilities. So there's this sort of ironic contradiction that we're a target. We claim we need to be involved in these activities to protect ourselves, but the thing that puts us at risk is exactly those entanglements.
Mm.
So it's been recognised for decades that those facilities in Australia are priority nuclear targets, and that's been reinforced more recently by Chinese statements making it very clear that the AUKUS arrangements and Australia's increasing enmeshment with the United States nuclear forces makes Australia even a higher priority target. And many military strategists have argued that, in fact, it may be those targets may, in fact, be of a higher priority from a military perspective even than United States targets per se. Because, for example, if it comes to an escalating war between China or Russia and the United States, then one way to demonstrate intent and seriousness without necessarily inviting full-scale nuclear retaliation would be to attack US military infrastructure like bases in Australia earlier, before you attack Los Angeles or Washington or New York, inviting inevitable large-scale retaliation to prove that you're serious and encourage de-escalation. So, in a sense, these are even more vulnerable, perhaps, than specifically United States military targets because of that capacity for them to be used to demonstrate serious intent and be a warning.
Yeah, and I suppose also because of their role in relaying information about missile activity, about various other kinds of moves, their surveillance capabilities as well, that then actively inform the United States decision-making around targeting. Now, I've kept you on for a long time, Tillman, so I really appreciate you joining us. I just wanted to wrap up by asking about what you're keeping an eye on when it comes to assessing increasing nuclear threat in the U.S.-Israel war on Iran.
Well, this is such a worry. You know, this is another, in addition to the attack we had last year, illegal attack, completely contrary to the UN Charter and any justification. Iran doesn't pose any kind of acute military threat to the Israel or the United States. This is the most blatant example of the pot calling the kettle black that you could possibly imagine. Two nuclear-armed states, including the only nuclear-armed state in the Middle East, attacking a state which doesn't have nuclear weapons, and by the United States, which ripped up the previous Iran nuclear agreement, that was effectively putting the most stringent constraints that any country has ever accepted on its nuclear program, and providing really strong reassurance that Iran's program could not in any foreseeable way contribute to nuclear weapons development. That was working effectively over several years that it was implemented. The International Atomic Energy Agency that was monitoring that agreement with permanent presence of inspectors on the ground and constant remote environmental and video surveillance monitoring certified every 3 months that that agreement was working for over 3 years. It was completely irresponsible to trash that agreement. And so this, you know, Mike is right, this non-proliferation by indiscriminate military, unilateral military attack is a recipe for proliferation. So, you know, the lesson for every other country that's a potential target for regime change or hostile action by the United States or its allies will take the lesson that they're likely to take from this is that you're much safer. In fact, the only way to be safe is to have nuclear capacity yourself. This is really the worst possible approach to non-proliferation. And if Iran was not determined to acquire a nuclear weapon before this, then the chances of Iran in the future, unless there is really substantial regime change that's hard to foresee at present, given the strength and highly embedded nature of the regime and its massive military and security apparatus throughout the country. This action is very likely to make any future agreement and monitoring to constrain Iran's nuclear program more difficult or impossible and increase the likelihood of nuclear weapons development there. So it's completely counterproductive as well as completely illegal and inhumane. The possibilities for escalation of this are really multiple, both through the direct use of either Israeli or American nuclear weapons. China and Russia, friends of Iran, have so far been quite slow to be involved. But, you know, Pakistan could... There are multiple ways that this could go very badly. So I think it's of really profound concern for the world. We live in extremely dangerous times and really... There are no right hands for the wrong weapons, I think, is the lesson. We absolutely need to take nuclear weapons out of the picture in this dangerous, climate-stressed world.
Thank you so much, Tillman. I think that is an excellent note to leave it on and a really important reminder and call to action. And we will put information in our show notes about how to find out more about ICAN's work and urge the Australian government to ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Thank you again.
Terrific. Thanks very much, Peter.
And that was Tillman Ruff, co-founder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, speaking with us about Australia's entanglements with nuclear-armed states in light of the ongoing U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:44 in the morning. 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. And now we will play an excerpt of Agapi Pashos of the Greek Democritus Workers League speech from the 20th of February this year on the third anniversary of the Tempe tragedy. This segment discusses decades of austerity and endemic corruption that led to the death of 57 people, but importantly, the diaspora's role in fighting for justice.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
Welcome, everyone. I want to thank you for coming here. We want to start with an acknowledgement of country. We are standing on Wurundjeri land, land that was stolen, never ceded. We're standing in solidarity with the Indigenous people of Australia, and we will always be allies in that fight in solidarity. We stand here today in front of the Greek consulate for the second year in a row. It's been 3 years since the crime that was the Tempe rail crash, which should not be called a crime. It was actually a murder of 57 innocent people at the hands of consecutive governments. It was a political decision that led to the murder of those people. It was a political decision to privatize the railways, a political decision to maintain a system that stands on profits instead of human life. I'll be speaking both in Greek and in English. So if you can't understand me, I'll get to you in a second. I'll be speaking in both languages. I wanted to start by saying that already in Greece there's been strikes and demonstrations by students, but also by workers. The railway is already shut in solidarity with the victims. There's already been high school occupations, there's already been university occupations, public meetings on their campuses are already starting. So we are part of an international movement. Last year there was protests in Sydney as well. Currently, I think there is 50 protests across the world and over 100 in Greece itself. I think one of the biggest things that this shows is that there isn't borders that divide us. There is only us and them. There's only the only thing that divides us is the fact that we have to take the train to get to work. We have to take public public transport to get anywhere we have to get to. We have to go to the public hospitals. We have to buy groceries that are at wild prices. While they don't have to worry about that stuff. They can take the private jets to go from country to country. They can take the private helicopters to go from city to city. And they can take the limousines to get to their office and whatnot. And we can see that in Greece in broad daylight, while at the same time as ordinary people are suffering trying to buy groceries, at the same time that even things like beef are considered luxury products. The rich and powerful of that country are raking it in farmer scandals, in working scandals. At the same time, people are working 13-hour days. A 13-hour day was defeated in Russia in 1906. And we're living today in 2026 fighting the same fight. So every single one of you here today should give yourselves a round of applause for being here, for being 15,000 kilometers away, but standing in solidarity with those people. So I want to start by inviting Agapi to speak. Agapi is a member of the Democritus Workers League. It's an organization that stood in the solidarity of Greek workers in Australia since 1935 and helping to lead the fight decades after. So give a round of applause to Agapi.
Good afternoon. Kalispera. I also acknowledge the land of Wurundjeri people, the land that we stand on, the land that we thrive on, and the land that was never ceded. Initially, I was going to speak in English, in Greek, but I think English is more appropriate seeing the audience. Okay. The Tempe tragedy is not simply a tragic accident. It is a historical turn point. A moment when Greek society was forced to confront the deep pathologies of a political and administrative system that for decades has downgraded public safety and turned essential infrastructure into a field of profit. When two trains collide head-on in 2013, 23. It is not a matter of human error. It is a systemic failure. At Denby, we saw a state operating through clientelistic logic, chronic shortages, and a constant shifting of responsibility. A state that left 57 dead and dozens of families submerged in grief. And instead of immediate clear accountability, we witness communication management, battles of impressions, and a public dialogue. Sorry. That often drifted away from what truly matters, the need for justice and institutional change. Denby is not merely a national tragedy. It is a test of collective conscience, and that test does not concern only those living within the Greek borders. It concerns us as well, the diaspora. It concerns especially Greek Australians who form one of the most historic, organized, and dynamic communities of Hellenism outside Greece. The diaspora is not a decorative element of the nation. It is not a tourist ambassador. It is a living part of the people. And when the people are tested, silence is not neutrality, it's a choice. In Melbourne, the largest Greek city outside Greece, we cannot confine our identity to cultural festivals, dance ensembles, and gastronomic evenings. Our culture is not only song, dance, and food. It is also memory. It is a deep political tradition of a people who have known dictatorship, exile, poverty, and struggles for democracy and social dignity. The first generation of migrants who arrived in Australia did not bring with them only recipes and music. They brought experiences of repression, poverty, civil war, and political persecution. They brought the knowledge that rights and safety are not given, they are won through struggle and protected through struggle. For this reason, the tragedy of Denby concerns us directly. It concerns us because 57 young people were lost, not in a natural disaster, but within a framework of state inadequacy and institutional laxity. It concerns us because the value of human lives has no borders. The diaspora has power, and that power is not only emotional, but political and moral. Denby is a threshold, a point at which we are called to prove that our relationship with Greece is not folkloric, but substantive. That love for the homeland is not expressed only through flags and marches, but through demanding a state that protects the lives of its citizens. And at the same time, it is a moment of honesty towards the diaspora. As Greeks abroad, we cannot be remembered only when the Greek state needs us. We cannot be brought into the political spotlight when electoral calculations arise or when arrangements such as postal voting are introduced. The voters are right and rightly institutionalised, but our relationship with the homeland cannot be reduced to an envelope opened every 4 years. The diaspora is not an electoral reservoir. The diaspora is not a reserve audience. The diaspora is not symbolic capital activated occasionally. We are the citizens with a voice, with judgment, with political memory. We are communities that supported Greece in difficult periods, financially, morally, internationally. And we demand a reciprocal, stable, and substantive relationship. A relationship that does not end with a counting of votes, but extends to accountability, transparency, and respect. Denby calls on us to say clearly, we do not want to be remembered only when our participation at the ballot box is needed. We want to be recognized as an active part of Hellenism with a right to speak and to demand institutional seriousness. If the state, the Greek state, seeks our participation through postal voting, then it must also accept our political stance when it is critical. It must respect our vote, that our vote is not decorative. It is a conscious choice connected to values and principles. Denby is the point at which we say that our Greek identity is not museum-like. It is alive. And when life is devalued, we do not remain silent. Our demands. We have a duty to stand publicly beside the families of the victims, to demand full transparency and meaningful accountability, to organize events of remembrance and public awareness, to use our community networks, media, and institutions so that the issue is not forgotten, to demonstrate that Greek identity in the diaspora includes social responsibility and active engagement with issues that affect human lives.
Δεν ήταν ατύχημα, ήταν δολοφονία. Αυτό εδώ το έγκλημα έχει ιστορία. Δεν ήταν ατύχημα, ήταν δολοφονία.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:56 in the morning. That was an excerpt of Agapi Pashas of the Greek Democritus Workers League speaking on the 28th of February this year, which marked the third anniversary of the Tempe train crash tragedy. And that segment discussed the decades of austerity and endemic corruption leading to the death of 57 people and the Greek diaspora's role in fighting for justice and systemic change in Greece. Now, there's a public meeting to discuss the political crisis in Greece at Democritus House, 583 High Street in Northcote, on Saturday, the 14th of March at 4 p.m. So this coming Saturday, the 14th of March. For more information, you can visit their Instagram, which is at Greek Democritus League, or you can check our show notes for further information.
And then we play an excerpt of Carnegie's Women of the Line interview with Avika about combating the climate crisis through regenerative farming, the role of women in sustainable farming, and the links between corporate farming and patriarchal culture, and the benefits of growing your own food. And Avika is a regenerative farmer in Chiang Mai in Thailand. Now, listening back to this, I was really thrown by how similar it was to a lot of the issues that are coming out of Punjab and farmers' protests that we've also covered, but also how a lot of Thai farmers also are having to leave to or being expelled by Israel to, do the farming work over there. And there's a lot of, links between being able to, regenerate for yourself or having to go somewhere else and work. So I thought that was really interesting and very important. So let's take a listen today.
Okay, so there was a difference before between food being grown by women and women being involved in agriculture as something that wasn't corporatized. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So has the corporatized nature of it made a difference to how women are involved in it?
Yeah, to some extent, because you're no longer kind of growing food for your families and your community, but rather you have to kind of work as a day laborer with like minimum wage. So it becomes more of a job rather than a sort of like something that communities have done for sustenance. It then kind of shifts the dynamic to them needing to have employment and then kind of becoming day laborers in that way. So there's this shift in that way.
Yeah, that's really interesting in how that might shift a woman's societal role as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think, in the last probably 30, 40 years, a lot of women have had to go out and look for jobs as well, even in rural Thailand. So a lot of agricultural work in Thailand are done by women, especially things like labor intensive jobs like weeding or planting, or especially in the area where our farms are, a lot of women take these day jobs to grow like corn or tobacco and such. Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about what impact that has on women in the space?
Yeah. So like modern day agriculture is mainly monocropping. Like you'll just see fields of corn and rice being grown, which is maybe normal for people today, but it's actually very abnormal for just agriculture in general. It's like a very like aggressive way of farming. It's very destructive in a way, where they use these big machineries and they're using like GMO species of seeds that cannot be locally saved and cannot be locally kept by the community. And then on top of that, they're using fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides that these massive corporations are, that they have to rely on. You know, there's no more sense of like self-sufficiency within the community to grow food. So you have to grow these certain very limited variety of food, monocrop it, and then kind of like your hands are pretty much tied in what you can do as a farming community. So that's why you see people kind of just grow the same variety of corn and rice all over the country. Monocropping is definitely not great, because if you look towards like in nature and how the natural systems have evolved, you'll never see like a monocrop system. You'll never see a big field of just rice being grown. It's always a diversity of plants that are there. So actually different types of plants work symbiotically together to improve soil and stuff. But if you're only growing one variety, it depletes nutrients from the soil, and there's sort of no practice of kind of adding those nutrients back into the soil.
So you were saying that this monocropping and modern day agriculture is informed by patriarchal culture?
Yeah, very much. I think so. I think very much so. Because you can imagine when women were responsible for providing sustenance for their families and for their communities, they would grow a variety of things that could feed their families, right? And whatever was in season, they would just grow and eat. And that's kind of very beautiful in a way. And you come to respect your land and the food, and you understand how your life is so connected to the food that is provided, is, you know, that you're eating. But when you talk about modern day agriculture and monocropping, that connection has been lost. And it's mainly just become a commodity that we're all, like all these farmers are subjective to having to be a part of, because there's no other way. Like the market is, it's so difficult that almost every farmer is subjected to this global trade of monocropped, like the few crops that are grown around the world. Like every farmer is pretty much subjected to that now. And those crops are like corn, rice, cotton, and maybe a few more things. But that's why you don't really see diversity anymore, even in the varieties of rice that are grown. Like I think in Thailand, there used to be hundreds of varieties of rice that were grown. But now it's been like narrowed down to maybe 10 at most that are grown. I don't know, man, it just sucks. Like modern agriculture is just a shit show, just to be completely honest. It's like, it's a shit show, and I think it's a very fragile system. Like the modern day agriculture, it's super fragile. And like, I don't know, a lot of countries struggled during COVID, right? Because depending on these synthetic fertilizers that have to be imported, is crazy to grow your own food. And if like the global supply chain was to one day be interrupted somehow, like a country can't no longer sustain itself. That's not a very, it's way too fragile.
it makes sense what you're saying, that it's gendered, because when women were doing it, it was needs-based, and it was from what you're saying sounds like a reciprocal relationship between people and nature and the earth. But once something becomes commodified,
yeah, it becomes like an extractive process.
Yeah,
in a way. Yeah, and it's modern day agriculture is a super taking kind of, it just takes from the land, and yeah.
And the gendered nature of that is really interesting, because it coincides with men taking over this process, right?
It's very aggressive. I think it's been normalized, but it's so aggressive how modern day agriculture is practiced and how extractive the whole process is. There isn't even care to tend to the soil. It's just you put these really like chemicals that are sold to you by these corporations, and there isn't a thought to people anymore that they need to care for the soil and to give back to it. It's just so commodity driven. Yeah,
right. And your practice and your farm and the agriculture space you're in, it's organic farming, right?
Yes, it's organic farming, but we also practice something called regenerative farming as well. Regenerative farming is just, as you practice farming, your soil actually begins to regenerate and your farm becomes healthier, and the system that you're working in starts to kind of give back to itself. So very much the opposite from what monocropping is.
The type of regenerative farming that you do, is it derived from indigenous farming knowledge in Thailand?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, now I think it has, yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah, because, yeah, farming knowledge used to just be passed on from families and communities, and how the soil is sustained and how you give back to the soil is something that is passed on. And yeah, so absolutely, like, that's something we definitely learn from indigenous communities, and yeah.
So Thailand, I think like most places, is having a bit of a climate crisis. Like we just had really hectic floods. People are really worried that the burning season is going to get a lot worse. The pollution is going to get a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
What positive impacts do you think regenerative farming can have on the climate crisis?
Personally, we actually think a lot of the problems that we're going to face in the future with climate change and the climate crisis can actually be solved by addressing issues with farming and kind of switching to a more regenerative approach to farming. So for example, with burning, it's a huge issue in Thailand. And the reason, I don't know if you know this, but the reason that a lot of farmers burn is because it's the most sort of like cheapest way or most cost-effective way for them to clear their land for the next like farming season. And the reason they have to burn is because their crop residue doesn't degrade on their land. So that's because, I mean, that kind of all ties back to the fact that the farming techniques that they use are very destructive. So their soil has become barren. So essentially whatever's on their soil is not going to degrade. So if you leave it to sit there forever, it's never going to go anywhere. It's just kind of going to sit there. And they're like, well, we have to farm for the next season. What can we do? So then they choose to burn it. But actually healthy and living soil is kind of, it will be full of microbes that can actually disintegrate these crop residue. So once those microbes, if you add them back to the farm and actually help the crop residue degrade, hence nobody really actually has to burn. So it's a pretty simple like solution to the problem. And that's one of the things that we're working on at Living Roots as well, is figuring out how to revitalize land and soil in a very, in a regenerative way, but also a lot quicker to help with the climate crisis. Because if you can do it slowly, but we won't be able to keep up with all of the changing environments and stuff. Yeah.
Have you spoken to other farmers and other people in the agricultural space about this? And what are people saying? Like, are they receptive to trying this? Or are people a bit like, no, this is not how it's done? Or
Yeah. I think they're definitely receptive to trying out a new way of farming. It depends, because generally organic hasn't really been, especially in Thailand, doesn't have the best reputation. It just has a reputation that it's really difficult and people don't generally really like it, which is not great. Yeah, people are receptive, especially people who have seen how damaging crop burning can be are definitely open to finding a solution to fix the problem.
I feel like burning is such a huge, huge issue up here in Chiang Mai.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people are like actively advocating to stop. So it's good to know that people are really open to, you know, a real solution that sounds like it's not that difficult to implement.
Yeah, there are definitely some challenges, but, and it's a long-term endeavor. It's definitely not like in 1 year all of our problems will be fixed, but it's a long term. We're looking like 5 years, 10 years.
Yeah.
Long term sustainable solution. But yeah, it's definitely a solvable problem. Like, nobody needs to burn.
So our listeners in Australia might not know this, but Thailand has been sending people to Israel to work in farming communities. And Human Rights Watch has recently released a report talking about the abuses they're facing and the really, really horrific conditions and long hours and inhumane and unsafe living conditions with very, very little pay. They've resulted in several deaths. You know, as someone in the agricultural space, what do you think about this? And why is it happening? Why are people going? And what do you think are the impacts?
What's happening is not unique to just Thai workers going to Israel, for example, to be like migrant laborers. You often see this abuse happening when any like people from third world countries maybe move to work as migrant laborers in the first world country. It's like a very common situation that they're subjective to these awful labor conditions. But I think the interesting question you asked was, why is this happening? Because I was shocked too, because Thailand is quite a country with rich natural resources. And like, it's kind of terrible to see people migrating to a different country to work as agricultural laborers. I think there's been a huge problem in like the Thai agricultural farming practices in general, where a lot of farmers can't make it work anymore on their land. Like, the cost of input that they need to put into farming here is becoming way higher than what they're able to get out of their farm. So that's why we see a lot of people migrating, if not to Bangkok, then to outside the country, like to Israel. And then you're subjected to all of these like terrible conditions where you have no community and basically nobody, you have no rights basically. If people are not migrating to Israel, they're leaving their homes where they used to farm to maybe go to Bangkok and try to like work as a, I don't know, Grab driver or motorbike driver. I think it all is just because like they can't make their land work for them anymore. Like, to some extent, the soil that they must have been farming on or their family must have been working on is so degraded that no matter how much they put in, they can't make it work. for them. So, you know, they have to leave their homes and find other opportunities for work.
And that was the excerpt of Carnegie's Women on the Line interview with Avika last year in March about combating the climate crisis through regenerative farming, the role of women in sustainable farming, and the links between corporate farming, patriarchal culture, and the importance of growing your own food, as well as Thai workers and Israel's agricultural relationship. So you can catch Women on the Line on 3CR Mondays from 8:30.
3CR.
And we are now joined by Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch to continue the conversation about the Australian government's relationships with US-based data analytics company Palantir in light of exclusive reporting this week by Crikey on the contents of a contract embedding Palantir staff within the Department of Defence. Good morning, Lucinda.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Of course. This is a developing story. You've been on Thursday breakfast, on Tuesday breakfast, on a bunch of our breakfast shows a couple of times this year, you know, talking about increasing revelations about the extent to which the Australian government is integrating Palantir's software into their operations. But this week, Crikey obtained a copy of the $7.1 million contract signed between Palantir and the Department of Defence in 2024, intended to enable the creation of Australian industrial intelligence capability using Palantir's data integration and analytics platform Foundry. Now, what is Foundry and what capabilities does it afford? And beyond Foundry, do we know of any other systems that Palantir has created that the Australian government is using?
Yeah, absolutely. So Foundry is their main offering for like commercial and corporate environments. And it basically takes all of that data and then turns it into a unified kind of searchable database. And because it's typically for corporate environments, it's more about like finding maybe workers, which they can lay off, or kind of corporate shortcuts, which they might be able to take to save money. So it has a bit more of a financial focus. Beyond Foundry, we know that Gotham is being used by the government. Now, all of their systems have quite dorky names, so you will have to excuse that. Gotham is an investigative platform, and it's used by militaries, police forces, as well as intelligence agencies. And kind of like Foundry, it takes all of that data an agency has and then it breaks it down into its smallest components and finds the connection. So the outcome is a unified, searchable web of data. AUSTRAC, which is the financial intelligence body for Australia, has an $8 million contract with Palantir for Foundry and Gotham, Department of Defence, Australian Signals Directorate, and the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission are all believed to be using Gotham as well.
And Gotham is has been implicated in Israel's genocide in Gaza, has it not, in terms of automated targeting?
Yes, absolutely. So Gotham is believed to be the platform which they use to decide where missiles should be targeted.
Yeah, so really concerning to hear about the connections and, engagement of the Australian government with this company. Now, on top of affording Palantir regulatory flexibility around financial reporting, it appears that this latest contract also narrows auditing provisions so that only the Auditor General and Australian National Audit Office are able to apply, you know, a high level of scrutiny to Palantir's operations. What concerns do you have about that arrangement?
Yep. So typically the federal government can access contractor premises and review operations, but as you noted, these powers have been narrowed down to a single office. So with a company like Palantir, with such a poor human rights record, narrowing the oversight of their actions seems like a really big mistake. I mean, one of the reasons, just practically, it's narrowing the amount of people who can raise the alarm, and it's narrowing the amount of people who can, you know, identify red flags. And in such a high-stakes situation, it's really hard to understand why the government would choose to do that.
And it also looks like cybersecurity requirements have been pared back in this contract so that Palantir only has to notify the Department of Defense of confirmed cybersecurity attacks. And it also excludes the possibility of defense conducting penetration testing on Palantir software. Can you take us through the implications of that, where it's not just regulatory oversight, but also these concerns about security and cyber attacks?
Yeah, so it's definitely very concerning that the contract has removed those standard requirements. So Palantir is handling sensitive Australian consumer data here. So if there's any chance of it leaking or being compromised, I don't understand why the Department of Defence would not want to know about that. You know, Palantir holds so much data, and as they become more and more integrated into Australia, they're going to be holding more and more intimate Australian data on every person who's listening right now. So for them to not have to alert the government that they think there's been a breach is so concerning. The contract also prohibits penetration testing without Palantir's authorization. So penetration testing is when defence or anyone tries to hack into a contractor's systems to ensure that they are secure. To allow this only when Palantir has okayed it is problematic, because Palantir could simply not authorize it, and then the security of their system goes unchecked. Or Palantir is basically getting a heads up before they get penetration tested. And this means that it gives them a chance to perhaps rearrange their systems and tighten things up. And so we're not getting an honest picture of how secure their handling of Australian data actually is.
Yeah, and I understand that Digital Rights Watch sought information from Katie Gallagher's office last year regarding the Australian government's contracts with Palantir. And something that did strike me while I was reading the response from Gallagher's office, which you've published on your website, was the fact that a lot of the discussion of privacy protections there covered issues of misuse, breaches, and mishandling. But that doesn't really touch on the enormous harms of what is identified by government as legitimate data use and sharing. So could you share any reflections on that?
Yeah, so you've touched on a great point there. The current privacy laws allow for really harmful practices. A few examples of things that are entirely legal under Australian law: political parties and their volunteers can collect detailed data on voters, figuring out exactly what issues matter to them, and then they can micro-target political messaging to them. A lot of people would say that undermines democracy. You know, and if a voter wanted a political party to delete the profile that they had collected on them, the political party would be under no obligation to do so, because not only are they exempt from the Privacy Act, but we also lack deletion rights. So you have no ownership over the commercial data that is collected about you. So we are in desperate need of privacy reform, because so many of the data-driven harms that we see happening out there in the world today are entirely legal.
Yeah, that is a really important point to emphasize, where when we are getting these reassurances from government about compliance with legality, questioning what is legal is something that allows us to really get an understanding of the extent to which, you know, sharing of our data, mining of our data, is actually perfectly compliant. Now, what are some developing issues that you're keeping an eye on in the digital rights space in Australia?
Yeah, so the privacy concerns regarding age verification, that's very topical right now. This is something that under 16s, and I guess over 16s, encountered a few months ago when they had to verify they were over 16 to keep their social media accounts. But from last week, all porn websites are now required to verify that a user is over the age of 18 through collecting government ID, bank details, face verification, or any other approved form. Now, firstly, age verification does not work. It can easily be skirted, and it disproportionately misages people of colour and women. But just because it isn't effective at its stated purpose, it doesn't mean that it isn't harmful. So age verification systems, they're up to the porn websites to run. So they might not have the money or the know-how to effectively secure the really sensitive data they collect. So we're talking bank details, government IDs, face scans of Australians trying to just watch porn. If that data is compromised, those logs could become public. Alternatively, fake porn sites may run age verification scams, and Australians could end up really vulnerable to having that information leaked or used against them in blackmail. So definitely the issue that is on my mind this week is the privacy concerns regarding age verification.
Yeah, and in terms of finding out more about this and raising concerns with government, what can our listeners do?
So if you want to stay informed about this, head to Digital Rights Watch, and we have a fortnightly newsletter that we send out which covers all of the tech policy and human rights updates. And we also have several campaigns you can join so that you can fight for your data rights, including your right to delete that data about you. If you are wanting to act on this issue, joining one of our campaigns is a great place to start. If you want to do something independently, write to your local representative and tell them that you care about this issue. It can be a quick email and it can make all the difference.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much, Lucinda. And we will have links to Digital Rights Watch's website in our show notes. Appreciate you making the time this morning.
My pleasure.
And that was Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch speaking with us about the Australian government's relationships with US-based data analysis software company Palantir in light of exclusive reporting this week by Crikey on the contents of a contract embedding Palantir staff within the Department of Defence. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we are coming to the end of our show today. So we will take you through a quick roundup of what we covered this morning. First up, we were joined by Tilman Ruff, co-founder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, to talk about Australia's entanglements with nuclear-armed states in light of the ongoing US-Israeli war on Iran.
Then we heard it. Excerpt from the Greek Democritus Workers League speech from the 28th of February this year on the third anniversary of the Tempe train tragedy, which took the lives of 57 people and uncovered a lot of corruption. And then we played an excerpt of Carnegie's Woman on the Line interview last year, interviewed with Avika about combating the climate crisis through regenerative farming and the links between corporate farming and patriarchal culture.
And as you just heard, we were joined by Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch. Now, we've got a couple of events that we wanted to plug that are happening this week, Inez.
Yes, it is Camp Sovereignty celebrating 20 years today on Thursday, the 12th of March from 5:30. So please join them at King's Domain or Camp Sovereignty and reflecting on the history of the Black GST and Camp Sovereignty movement.
And there's also the Democritus Workers League meeting to discuss the political crisis in Greece at Democritus House, 583 High Street in Northgate, on Saturday, the 14th of March at 4 p.m. And you can find out more by visiting their Instagram, which is at Greek Democritus League, or by checking our show notes where we'll have a link to it. And finally, Pickett Ansel is having a... there's going to be a picket against Ansel to stop slavery in the supply chain, and you can join the picket punishing companies using slavery in their supply chains and seeking full compensation for the Medisaram workers at Ansel's head office, 678 Victoria Street in Richmond, Victoria, on Friday, the 27th of March at 1 p.m. So again, there is a rally to picket Ansel, stop slavery in the supply chain, 678 Victoria Street in Richmond, on Friday, the 27th of March at 1 p.m. You've been listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And
yes, on Sunday as well, there's a commemoration for the 51 Muslim martyrs of the Christchurch Massacre. That will be on Saturday. Sunday, the 15th of March at 12 p.m. at the State Library.
Yes, please go and attend that rally if you can. It's really important to stand against Islamophobia at the moment in particular. So that's all we've got time for on today's show. We will catch you next week. But until then, take care. Bye.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.